Well, you know, I have kind of a rule. I try to read the books of everybody that I interview, always have, and it's I think it's really helpful because you get inside the mind a little bit more, and you find those little doors and windows by reading the book that you wouldn't if you're just reading the PR material. Those little doors and windows that give you a way in to talk about the subject, which other people might miss. But I'll confess, I haven't read Havana Harvest. It's a new novel by Robert Landori. It arrived on my doorstep a little too late in the week for me to get into it much, but I did read about a chapter of it just to make sure that he wasn't a schmo. And it's good. It's really good, actually, and it's fun. I love adventure novels from time to time. You're going to like this one. But more than that, you're going to like Robert. He was born in Hungary, and he spent a lot of his life as a senior public accountant. He worked very closely with banks in the Cayman Islands. He knows everything about the secret life of these secret bank accounts, the people that profit from them, the people that exploit them, the international financiers, the con men, the other people who try to take advantage of these systems, both legally and not. And so we'll talk about that and money laundering too. And how much are we really talking about? And where are the intelligence organizations involved in these types of programs? What do they turn a blind eye to? What do they do themselves? You know, somebody mentioned last hour in open lines about black budgets, right? And how some things are funded. What kind of money's going through the Cayman Islands? And who's behind it all? We'll get to that next with Robert Landori on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Robert Landori, I've read a couple of your bios, but I think I still find you a man of mystery, and that the bios all say the kind of the same thing. So before we get going tonight with our topic, let me first welcome you to Coast, and try to find out a little bit more about you before we find out about what you know. How about that?
That's fairly fair. Good morning. How are you?
I like that laugh. It was slightly sinister. And I know that you're not. I mean, you were an accountant, and you were everything you were doing, at least to some degree, was above board. But tell me more about how you got involved with offshore banking and how you describe money laundering. How did you get into that professionally?
In 1967, there was an expo in Montreal, and I had a client who was a Montrealer and who decided that he wanted to move away from the cold weather. And he moved down to Grand Cayman, and he started a bank. And when he started his bank, he suddenly realized that he needed an accountant to set up a banking system. I shouldn't say banking system, but an accounting system for him. So he gave me the job to do that, and I did. And some years later, when his bank got into trouble and he needed somebody who would help him out of the mess, he called me up and he said, "Look, it looks to me that I'll have to go bankrupt. And I need somebody who speaks all these languages that I need to sort of supervise the orderly winding up of my affairs." And so he appointed me as his trustee in bankruptcy. And you know what trustees in bankruptcy do? They take over the assets of the bankrupt company and they sell them off. And they then try to put as much money back into the hands of the creditors as possible. So I and two other trustees in bankruptcy were put in charge of an operation that involved 107 companies and three banks, all of them centered on the Cayman Islands, but spread all over the world. Does that give you an idea of the magnitude and of the intricacy of the thing?
Other than Hungarian and English, what other languages do you speak, Robert?
Well, I speak Hungarian, I speak English, I speak French, I speak Spanish, I speak German. I speak those well enough to go and, if necessary, go to court and plead in it.
That's good enough. Now, so then what did you find when you started to detangle the mess of these Grand Cayman banks?
Well, you know, the intent was good in the sense that the banks tried to operate like any normal bank anywhere in the world. The problem in this particular instance was that the banker was investing long-term with short-term money. In other words, when you go to a bank and you put your money in, you also want to have it back whenever you want it. But he calculated that statistically this would allow him a 1 in 20 ratio of being able to use it. But of course, when a crash comes, such as the one we're living through now, and such as the one that happened in 1974, you have to return all the money that your depositors have with you. And then you just run out of money if you have it invested in, let's say, land that is waiting to go up in value.
Right. I see that. So what's different about the banking rules in the Caymans that, A, made it attractive for this guy to go leave from Montreal and go to the Cayman Islands and start a bank? What made that attractive then? And what makes it attractive for people to put their money in a bank in the Caymans as opposed to a bank in Montreal?
Well, the Bank of Montreal actually had a branch in the Cayman Islands because they realized that there would be many Montrealers who would want to put their money there in order not to pay taxes on what they were earning there.
In
the
Canada.
Attraction in general terms is, well, actually the attraction, you know, Ian, are two. One of them is that nobody knows that you have money there and consequently they can't get at it. And two, you don't have to pay taxes on the interest that you earn.
Now, is that true for everybody, everywhere? I mean, if I had an extra $2,000, I could just wire it to a bank in the Caymans, and nobody would, it would be a secret bank account that nobody would know about, and it would, all the interest I got on that $2,000, I would be able to keep without tax.
In theory, yes. In practice, no.
Okay.
You have to go back a little bit. You know, in 1934. When Hitler became power in Europe, there are a number of people, especially the Jewish people, were beginning to worry about what's going to happen to them. And they decided that they wanted to have a safe haven, not so much for tax purposes, but for just safety's sake. And the Swiss, the clever Swiss, who are clever and very methodical, invented what was known as the numbered account. That is to say that you had an account in Switzerland, and most German Jewish people tried to do that. You had a numbered account in Switzerland where nobody knew who the name was that owned that particular account. All you had was a number. And all you had to do is turn up and say the number, and they would give you back your money. This was for safety, particularly for safety reasons. This is how this thing all started. And then some clever boys in other jurisdictions outside of Switzerland said to themselves, well, hey, if the Swiss can do it, we can do it. So why don't we have a banking system, which will be a legitimate banking system in this particular country, as Grand Cayman or Liechtenstein or Monaco or what have you. And we're going to do the same thing that the Swiss are doing, except that we're going to attract the money into Grand Cayman. Now, pretty soon, the governments of the countries after the Second World War realized there was a movement towards these secrecy areas. And these governments said, hey, this is not good. When Joe, who lives on Maple Street, pays his taxes and Henry, who lives on Jones Street, does not, that well, there's something unfair. There's no social justice in it. So we better make sure that they pay both of them their taxes in order to support their government system. And so the rule was changed, and it said, if you have money offshore, you can have the money offshore, but you have to declare it and you have to pay your taxes on it. So today, as we progress into the 21st century at a rapid pace, we have a situation in which it's not so easy to send your $2,000 offshore. Mm-hmm. And forget about it. As a matter of fact, you know, Ian, they won't take your money.
They won't?
Well, you know, they're really scared. People like the United States of America and Germany are really actively discouraging this kind of behavior. And the banks are told, listen, if you're going to take these kinds of deposits and not cooperate with us, we're going to start putting pressure on you in the United States, and the United States banks won't do business with you. So people in the Cayman Islands, perfectly legitimate, very large banks, such as the Bank of Montreal, the Bank of Nova Scotia, and many American banks, Citibank, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They all have branches there, but you have to have a very, very good and fair reason to go there, because if they don't know you, they won't take your money. Hmm. So if Ian Punyat or Robert Landori send down $2,000, they return it. Thank you very much. We don't want it.
That's funny. Now, what if I sent down $2 million?
That's getting to be more difficult. You know, it's always a question of size, isn't it?
Yeah.
They look at it and with regret, they turn it down. But if you arrive there with a bag of money and you can persuade them to look at the origin and it is not, from a bank robbery or something like that, they might take it. And, of course, if it's General Motors, right?
Right.
Or one of these big corporations that does international trading, they'll take the money. And this is the big thing that we have to understand. We're talking about flight capital here. And there is legal flight capital and illegal flight capital.
Well, let's define that term, flight capital, for people that don't know it.
Well, flight capital would be money that goes away from where you live. It flies away, it runs away. You live in the United States and you put your money in Germany. Okay, in a way that is like flight capital. It doesn't give you anything except that you now have money in Germany. You have to pay taxes on the money there, and especially because of Germany having an agreement between the United States and Germany in which they report to each other about the incomes and the money movements of a customer. So that is what we have to understand. There are perfectly legitimate reasons why there is flight capital away from a country. Because, for example, right, I said General Motors, right? General Motors has an operation all over the world. They buy material here, and they send it over there,
right?
And they make a slight profit on this internal transaction, right? They deal in the foreign exchange, and they make money on the exchange or lose money on the exchange. And this money they trap in places like Bermuda, or Liechtenstein, or the Channel Islands, or Grand Cayman. This is legitimate stuff that is kept straight on the books of the companies that do this. In other words, General Motors in Detroit keeps track on their books of the money that they have in these particular jurisdictions.
Right.
This is flight capital, but it's legitimate.
All right, now I'm gonna pause you there to say, and we're talking with Robert Landori, who is an expert on money laundering and offshore accounts, and we'll talk more about flight capital. But just to make sure I get it straight, General Motors could, through their banking operations, they could send all of those profits back to a bank in Detroit. And then they would be paying U.S. tax on the profits that show up on that bank in Detroit, or of all of the places they could let that money land, they allow the profits to land in the Grand Caymans, and there they at that point at the Grand Cayman Island Bank, they don't pay taxes on it.
That is true.
Okay.
But when they start bringing it back to the United States, they do, for all the profit that they made there. As long as the money is in the Cayman Islands and book kept there, they're okay.
They have to put up a firewall.
Out of it, pardon?
They put up a firewall between Detroit and Cayman so that it never comes back in and out of Detroit.
Right, but it does come back because this fluctuates back and forth, and the interest portion of it is taxed in the United States of America.
Oh, is it? Okay. All right, so we'll get back to flight capital, I'm certain, but you mentioned before about the numbered Swiss accounts. And
yeah.
And the abuses, there was a ton of abuses that happened after World War II. Obviously, many families who had put money, holding it in good faith in Switzerland. We're told that they had Swiss bank accounts, but they may not have had the number, or there may have been a problem. And they lose family members during the Holocaust. And then after the war, they go to try to get that money out of those Swiss banks. And a lot of the Swiss banks, is, if I've got this straight, like UBS, who later on was sort of busted for this, they said, oh, we don't know what your money, we don't know who owns this money. When they could have lifted a finger and tried to find out who the money belonged to, they simply said, no, we don't know. And then they kept it. Isn't that true?
They tried to keep it, yes. It was a shameful act.
Yes.
What they did is originally when the pressure came, the Swiss banks got together and they stonewalled. And what they did is they said that, you know, all these people didn't have bank accounts, so they lost the records, and there were only $35 or $40 million worth of this kind of money in Switzerland. And a very courageous Jewish man in New York, Edgar Bronfman, who was the head of the Stiller's Corporation, who was, you know, he was a liquor merchant. I'm sure that you have drunk his whiskey. Said this. Pardon?
I laugh. I don't drink, but yes, I'm sure. I'm sure my wife has.
Well, you know that.
Right.
They were manufacturers of alcoholic beverages, whiskey,
sure,
etc. And they made a lot of money. And Bronfman was a very powerful man. And he went to the Swiss and said, look, you're not telling the truth. How come that you're saying these things? Anyway, he went and the Swiss tried to stonewall him, but he had money and he pressured them. And ultimately, the Swiss coughed up hundreds of millions of dollars worth of money that the Jewish people had put there,
right,
during the Holocaust. And some of it, of course, remained with the Swiss banks after 20 years because the owners died and there were no heirs. But the other people who could prove that they had an account, if they knew the number or they had a reasonable documentation that showed in which bank it was,
right,
they were refunded.
We shouldn't forget, too, just because I remember the story a little bit, the night watchman at the Union Bank of Switzerland, UBS, who was given the responsibility of burning the documents.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And who would have, if he had gone through what they told him to do, burn all these documents, there would have been no records. But he looked at it and he went, nope, this is wrong. And he turned it over to a local newspaper or something. And that's part of what started uncovering what they did at UBS was they had the paperwork.
Right.
Yeah. Which is amazing that the night watchman knew he was going to lose his job, but felt the moral responsibility to not let the bank get away with that, which I thought was pretty cool. So as it stands, and all of that was just to say, what are the rules now on getting a numbered anonymous bank account in Switzerland?
What are the rules?
The rules, what are, the rules now?
That they will not take your money unless you can show that, A, the money has not been obtained through crime, therefore you're not money laundering. B, that you are a legitimate business person or you had a legitimate reason for having an account over there. And C, that you comply with the requirements of your own country in tax-wise. Of course, you see, this is very elastically interpreted.
Yeah.
It's not a crime. Pardon?
No, I'm laughing again because I think that elastic is a good word to use for that. Right? So there's a little play in that, we would say, probably.
Well, there is a little play. Of course, there's a little play because you don't really, you cannot really police this. The thing is that there is a rule in Canada and the United States that you have to declare your world income, right? But if you're not a resident of the United States of America, you don't have to pay taxes on everything that you have in the world, just on a very small portion of it.
Well, hang on to that thought. We'll get back to that. We'll more with Robert Landori, and I want to hear the rest of that because we're talking about money laundering and offshore banking. We'll get more into what happened and about the CIA and all their intelligence agencies' involvement, too, on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking about the money laundering that goes on various locations around the planet. Notice that most of them were in Europe or in the Caribbean. I want to ask about Asian money laundering, too, coming up in just a second. Robert Landori is an expert. He's been working on Grand Cayman as kind of a forensic accountant. He went in there to figure out what was going on with a couple of banks that were crashing. One of his many ways that he's informed his novels, and he's got Havana Harvest that's out now. You can find that by clicking onto coasttocoastam.com. But we'll pick up right where we left off on the rules. Oh, no, wait. More like guidelines for when a Swiss bank will give you an account. And that, whenever time you use a term like elasticity, I hear in that bribery. The rules are elastic. What kind of money gets kicked back to the bank or to the banker to allow you to open up the account? We'll get to that next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. All right, we're talking with Robert Landori on Coast to Coast about offshore banking, the secrets of secret banking on Coast. So you were just saying that in the case of Switzerland, there are elastic rules that would make it possible for some people to be able to still get a numbered Swiss account, even if they don't meet the strict criteria that the banks established to try to make sure that no illegitimate money was being deposited. Is that about right?
Yes, you're right. But, you know, we're talking about a vast, vast subject. And although we're going to be together for a couple of hours or maybe even three, it is important to understand that, that we can't cover every single facet of the situation. And I would recommend, if I may, that people know, if they want some more information, they should go to my website at www.robertlandori.com if they want to find more details in detail. Okay. But, you know, with the Swiss, they have built a huge business of secret banking, right? And right. They're not going to go away just because we say boo.
Right.
And the Swiss will stonewall as much as they can in a legitimate way, and they will try to continue their hegemony and their network of secret bank accounts. And as you know, there was a clerk in one of the Swiss banks who sold a whole bunch of names to the Germans of people, wealthy Germans who had Swiss bank accounts in Switzerland. And the German tax authorities paid heavy duty money for it. And now the United States of America has approached some people in Switzerland, and they're also buying these lists. So what you have to understand is the effort that has to be made to recover these accounts is huge and difficult and very expensive. So they're not going to do it for Joe Smith, who has, let's say, a couple of hundred thousand or even $1 million in a Swiss bank account, right? They'll start going on the big, they'll start looking at the biggies, you know, $10 million and upwards. And there are plenty of those.
Yeah, I was going to say, and here on the anniversary of the conviction of Bernie Madoff, which sadly also saw the suicide death of his son. We still don't know where all of Bernie Madoff's money is. Is it possible that somebody like Bernie Madoff would still have a numbered Swiss account or money in a, you know, Cayman bank?
Absolutely. But, you know, it's not only you're talking about Switzerland. It's, I don't know, I think there are 37 or 38 legitimate offshore, so-called offshore banking centers. And people put money in these for various reasons. For example, in a nasty divorce case, the parties may want to put the money offshore in order not to have it seized by the other party before a court of competent jurisdiction finds in favor of one party or the other. Right? So it's not a tax thing, and it's not illegal. And therefore, the Swiss will say, well, look, how are we to know who is legal, who is illegal, who is doing this, who is doing that? We'll take the money prima facie, and we'll think about it afterwards.
Right.
And it's up to the Americans and the Canadians and the Brits to say, hey, Joe Smith is guilty, da 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 da. We know you have a bank account there. Where's the money? And we go after Joe Smith, and then he can make either a voluntary disclosure or deny, and stonewall, and take the consequences.
Right. But when you said before, too, about how some of these rules are more like, you know, guidelines, it made me think that I wonder whether how much bribery is involved. If you know somebody who's a Swiss banker, is it customary, or let's say Monaco or Cayman or wherever, I don't mean to pick on the Swiss, but is it possible that there's an expectation that if you bribe the right people, all of those rules just magically go away?
Well, you know very well that bribing is worldwide, and of course bribing works. But there's a limit, because a bank, in order to survive, has to comply today, with the world being just a small little globe. And they have to comply with international rules. And there are very, very, very serious sanctions against banks that encourage money laundering. And, I mean, it's understandable. Otherwise, you know, every bank robber would have his money offshore, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But imagine there's a clerk in Switzerland, right in Zurich, and somebody walks in whom he knows. Maybe it's a family friend or an attorney who has recommended a client and vouchsafes for the client's propriety, right?
Right.
He'll take the money and he'll say, look, I am covered by Swiss secrecy law. I have taken this money. If I am asked, I will only disclose what my country's laws, my Switzerland laws, say I have to disclose. Now, the American government and the Canadian government and the British government have gone to Switzerland and said, look, you want to do business in our countries? In the United States, we happen to be the world's largest economy. If you want to do business in our country, you better comply with our laws, not your laws. And then it's up to the Swiss banker to decide whether he takes the risk or not. I mean, there are incredible things that happen. It's very fashionable these days to talk about Saddam Hussein and how much money he laundered and how much money he actually had. And maybe one day, maybe now, I don't know, I'll tell you a little anecdote about what Saddam and his buddies accumulated in money.
Well, I think we have to
money
know.
With the help. Pardon?
Well, I think we have to know. Yeah, you can't tease us like that. We got to know. What do you know about Saddam's secret accounts?
Well, let me tell you this. We were talking about banks. This is the point. There was a U.S. company of Marines was walking along the outskirts of Baghdad at the, just after we won the war there. And I say we because we in Canada also have troops.
Sure.
There.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
And the guys got tired, you know, and they saw a villa that was abandoned. They went inside and they sat down. And they sat down. There was no furniture, so they leaned against the wall. You know how GIs are.
Sure.
And they started smoking. And when the sergeant got up, one of his buddies said, hey, Sarge, you're sweating like a pig. And the man said, I'm not sweating. And the guy says, well, look, your back is absolutely wet. And the sergeant said, you know, it does feel wet. What is it? So they felt the wall. And the sergeant, being a very thorough guy, kicked the wall. And the wall collapsed. And there was a gaping hole in it. And so they went through it. There was another room there. Obviously, the wall had just been erected a few hours before the troops arrived.
Huh.
And you know what they found inside?
No.
$600 million in bubble-wrapped, sealed money. Now, this begs the question, whose was the money?
Yeah.
Number two, how did it get there?
Yeah.
Right?
$600 million.
Guess who was in charge of distributing U.S. dollar bills in the Middle East at that time?
I don't have any idea.
UBS.
Union
des
Banques really?
Suisses.
I'll be darned.
You know? And so where this thing broke, the first thing that the American soldiers thought that this was all counterfeit. You know, shrink wrap banknotes
sure.
looked
right.
like Monopoly money.
Right.
And they started, they ripped one open and they played with it, and they played Monopoly. Literally, they played money. They didn't think it was real. And then some smart guy from Army intelligence took numbers and went to the Treasury. Every single solitary number was good. It was a real, real bunch of money. There was no counterfeit.
In U.S. currency?
In U.S. currency.
Oh, my God.
You know, Saddam had this oil for food program.
Right.
At a time, he was under sanction, and yet UBS did it. And there were American banks involved, too. You know, Bank of America, Citibank. I mean, there were sub-distributors who did this. And they did it because they make a lot of money at this. I mean, even a, a fraction of $600 million is a lot of money.
Yeah. 1% of $600 million is a lot of money. So,
hello. I think you and I could live on it.
Exactly. So there's all, again, we're talking with Robert Landori. Havana Harvest is his novel, but it's based on his experience working in secret banking. So at some point, though, with all of that money being moved around, doesn't it come to the attention of the CIA or other intelligence agencies around the world of who's doing what?
Well, you know what? Of course it does. And the CIA and the other intelligence agencies, MI6 from Britain and the Deuxième Bureau of France, get ready for this one. They use it. They use the system to do their own dirty work and the payoffs and run airlines through it and what have you. So they, of course, they know what the system is and who does what. I mean, look at the scandal that is surrounding Mr. Karzai's brother in Afghanistan. Do you know about that?
I've heard a little bit about it, and I know that it actually, the scandal isn't just limited to his brother, but also it touches the Karzai himself.
Well, I'm not really that au fait with whether Mr. Karzai himself is involved, but his brother arrived in one of the Arab states one day with $52 million in cash.
And
when they asked him, where did that come from? He said he didn't know because it was improper and illegal to take money of this kind out of the country. So they asked him very, very nicely to take it away. And he did, but we don't know where he put it.
Well, as a story I read in the New York Times not too long ago was talking about how that the aid to Karzai that would have overseen that money transfer was also tied to the CIA. And so as it gets as close as to President Karzai's right-hand man, one can only guess that the CIA and Karzai are up to speed on what that aid was doing, right?
I am not going to defend the CIA because I'm not in a position, I have no knowledge of it. But I have to tell you this, of course, there's a likelihood of that. But a lot of things are invention. And it's very fashionable to talk about the CIA and write about the CIA. Heck, you were talking about Havana Harvest? God sakes, this book is all about the CIA and its involvement in Cuba. And how the CIA was manipulating a poor general in Cuba, and he didn't even know that he really was working for the CIA. I mean, Havana Harvest starts in the Cayman Islands, where the Cubans had their secret money, and then it goes all around the world. And from this book, the reason why I wrote it was to illustrate what is really going on or possibly going on in the world of money.
Well, and that's just what we're exploring tonight on Coast. So and I'll explore some of the actual the real events that inspired the plot devices in your novel. Let me wrap up a couple of other questions here about the international banking piece, though. Besides
sure.
that, the CIA and other intelligence agencies, then they run their own operations through these secret accounts as a way of bypassing Congress, right? Bypassing any sort of oversight other than their own oversight, so they don't have to worry about anybody snooping into what they're doing. And I'm guessing from that the quid pro quo is if you look the other way for us, we'll look the other way for you.
Exactly.
So who gets
in
trouble?
You know, it's very difficult to have positive action when you are the CIA and you have to finance a mini war somewhere, right?
Right. So who gets a pass and who doesn't?
If I knew, I'd be a rich man. But I don't know.
Well, I mean, somebody somewhere has to get, you know, the CIA goes, okay, we don't want to know about it. We're going to be looking over here while you do that. And other people have got to get nailed for these things. And I just think, what's the deciding factor between those who get caught and those who get caught but then are, you know, released?
Well, there's one word for that. Power.
Yeah.
The guy who has the power gets away with it. Yeah. And you never hear the Swedes doing it, right? Because it's small, insignificant country's economy. The United States of America says, look, this is what we'd like to do. We know that it's kind of, you know, So, but let's do it anyway because we have to.
We'll hold our nose and do it. We think of the greater good or something like that, some construct that gives us permission to do it.
Let's take a guy whom you know, Castro, Fidel Castro.
Okay.
He has a secret bank account, which is not so secret. It's called the discretionary bank account, which I believe is in Panama. He has absolute control over this particular piece of money. And you know what he uses it for? When he decides that he wants to donate a hospital to Haiti, he just writes a check and he gives the money to the Haitian government for a Cuban-based hospital or a Cuban-financed hospital. Or if he wants to give relief to the Mexicans or the people from Nicaragua, he writes a check and sends medical supplies over there. It's a discretionary fund. It's not really a secret fund, but it's a fund that is outside the territory of Cuba, which he uses as he sees fit. There are other guys who are not so nice. There was this guy called Salinas in Mexico who stashed away gazillions of money in various bank accounts around the world because he just fluffed it off. And he never talked about it, and they're still looking for it. Mr. Madoff, I'm sure he did it too.
Yeah, but if Castro could write a check so easily to build a hospital in Haiti, couldn't he write a check just as easily to an organization to blow up a hospital in Nicaragua?
Oh, yeah, of course.
So yes, nobody would know. I mean, he has that kind of flexibility.
That's right.
And so we're not to presume that everything that Castro does on something like that would be only altruistic, right?
I never said that.
No. I'm just saying.
I happen to know.
Yeah. So, like, what kind of things? I mean, because you have sort of you've had a real. You're probably the first person I know that's had any kind of relationship with Castro and his government, and you have.
I have indeed.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, as a Canadian, when the revolution, when the so-called revolution triumphed, Canada never suspended any relationship with the with Castro's Cuba. In fact, there were only two banks that were clearing money into and out of Cuba internationally. One of them was a Russian bank called the Moscow Narodny Bank, and the other one was called the Royal Bank of Canada. And Canadians could travel freely between, and still can, between Cuba and Canada. And I actually, being a certified public accountant, which is called Chartered Accountant in Canada, had a business which was a mergers and acquisitions business, and we also did some international trade. And we supplied the Cuban government with medicine and spare parts and stuff like that. And that's how I started in my relationship with the Castro government, because one of my clients said, look, I'm a book dealer. I want to do deals with the Cuban government. I want to buy and sell rare books. And why don't you go there? You speak Spanish and organize some deals, which I did. So that's how it started. And slowly, 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 I began to work with the various agencies because everything was nationalized in Cuba in the end, right? I was dealing with the various agencies in Cuba. And one day, about 5 years or 6 years or 8 years into the situation, I got arrested for spying.
Well, then let's hang on to that story right there. We'll pick it right up where Robert Landori is taken in for spying in Cuba while he's down there on business, part of his background for Havana Harvest, his novel. We'll talk more about the secret money laundering business going on around the world on Coast to Coast.